welcome to Tasteland. I'm Francis Sear.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And today we are trying something new. We're doing two shorter conversations with a couple of journalists who had some really interesting pieces published last week. First, we'll be talking to Teddy Brown, who wrote a piece for the New York Times on Zyn and the tobacco pouch's masculine political symbolism. And then we will be talking to Emily Sugarman, who wrote a piece on direct-to-consumer women's health companies, how they're both changing and commodifying emergency contraceptives and birth control. So it should be a fun one. But first, a message from our sponsors, which is us.
A message from ourselves to ourselves. So just a reminder that we're raising money for the NWU Service Organization with our first live recording of Tasteland. The episode will be focused on worker-owned media collectives, and our guests will be Samantha Cole from 404 Media, Max Rivlin-Nadler from Hellgate, and Jasper Wang from Defector. And that will be taking place on November 16th in New York from 7 to 9 at 25 Broadway. It's the NWU office. It's behind the Wall Street Bull. You can't miss it. And we'll put more info and the ticket link in the show notes.
It'll be great. You better come. You should definitely come. I'll be there. Daisy will be there. Everyone
we
will be there.
We have to be there.
Yeah, we'll have to be there. Teddy talent. Is here, so let's chat.
Teddy, also here.
Hello. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Is anyone packing a Zyn in the upper decky right now?
No, say that I've now? Never Zyned. So, you know, let he without Zyn pack the first upper decky. I never Zyned. So, okay, well.
Tom, please keep that in for the record.
I guess to start, Teddy, you had this piece in the New York Times published on Halloween titled "What's That in Your Mouth, Bro?" Which is about.
Did you come up with that headline, Teddy?
The amount of headlines we went through. We were so Under This Influence was used by the American Lung Association in like an internal presentation, so we weren't allowed to use that for the headline. And I have no idea who wrote that headline, but I saw it and I was like, "That is." That wasn't the one I was thinking, but I'm glad we went with it.
How did you end up with this piece? Like, is this something that you were given or did you pitch it? How did it come to go through
like the sort of draconian process of like how things work with the Times sometimes is that I pitched this story probably 6 months ago. And we had talked about it a little bit. My editor, Marie Solis, who's just like the best. She has such a sharp eye for this stuff. And we talked a little bit about it. Wasn't the right time. And then eventually, once we got close to the election, they were like, okay, we need to run this, but we want to focus it on more of like the mass, like online masculinity aspect of it, which is a great topic. I mean, I think that some of the folks I talked to for the piece and who I'm really grateful to, we talked a lot about like the waning importance of symbols for this kind of stuff. And so like the political attachments to something like Zyn are relatively fleeting, but when you catch it, you have to hang on really tight and like ride the wave. And so it was very interesting to talk about that.
You mean if you're somebody like if you're Philip Morris, do you want to catch the wave?
Both Philip Morris and like podcasters like the Nelk Boys, like Tucker Carlson. Like I don't actually think Tucker Carlson gives a shit about Zyn, but I know that he wants the audience.
Well, he's being attacked by demons in his own bed, so I think he has bigger issues to worry about.
No, but you're
like, what if the demons just wanted a Zyn?
I'm trying to think of that profile.
They should make Zyn commercials that are like, "You're not you when you're hungry."
Who's the old head of Abercrombie who like actually thought he was being haunted by a Dybbuk? Like that was it.
This is the guy who was like arrested on sexual.
Not that
charges?
He's the original OG guy from like the Limited. That's a great probe. Like he.
Do you guys think the Babadook Zyns?
Six milligrams.
You keep so many Zyns in that top hat. Let me tell you.
Well, wait. I want to talk more about the Tucker Carlson bit for a second there. So I remember seeing the like reading that Zinternet piece that Max Reed wrote, however many months ago that was, and I don't know, like, what you're saying is like it's just a thing that like they, you know, somebody like Tucker Carlson sees these like young men rallying around and it's like, I'm gonna plant my flag in that, and like,
and he's
but
like,
that's
I want
only-
that. I want that audience. I think that's really what it comes down to. For you know, and Max was such an integral part of both like inspiration for this piece in the first place, and also like the actual writing and sort of the critical analysis of it. Mm-hmm. And he was like two things. It's like, it doesn't matter if you actually use it or not. It's about being attached to the symbol of it. Being attached to like sort of the wider sort of implications of what that means for like being fratty or like hard partying, but also like relatively healthy and like all these sort of right wing symbols that are really, really frayed. Like they're not really like there's no single thing for people to attach to you anymore. It's like a bunch of different things all over the place.
And then micro wellness cultures.
It's like bizarre. The fact that like reactionary politics is now like Andrew Huberman and Joe Rogan trying to biohack instead of like smoking as many Marlboro Reds as possible is like very funny to me.
Are cigarettes liberal?
It feels like cigarettes like are like lib now, which I think is very, very funny. But anyways, and Max was just such an important person reporting this out. So it was just like, I was trying to think of the other thing you said about this. But I think for someone like Tucker, it's like he isn't actually a political commentator anymore. He's like a podcaster, and you have to build an audience and keep an audience. And like he wants the Nuff Boys audience. So he's going to do stuff that associates him with these other people that he can access in the first place, because as like, as much as Tucker Carlson wants to be like, oh, I'm like a masculine guy. Like he's like a liberal urban elite from DC who is like a shitty CIA agent for a little while.
What about like his brand? So he has Alp, right? Is his brand coming out? And then there's Sesh. So, I mean, like, I feel like, you know, Zyn is like the Kleenex of nicotine pouches in that, you know, it's, you don't say, let me get a nicotine pouch. You say, let me get a Zyn. I don't know. Do you think like with other brand, maybe it's too early to say, but like with a Sesh or an Alp, like does that matter? Or is that just a way of like him consolidating some of his Zyn fandom?
It's a gold rush. That's all it is for people. Yeah. So PMI was like first to the marketplace, like their first movers. They have a ton of money. Obviously they're always going to like win a ton of shelf space, distribution, production, all that kind of stuff. But in the same way that a lot of vapes just winced the market and was like, we'll let the FDA chase us, like every product on the market right now does not actually have FDA approval to be out there. So like it's all provisional. Even Zyn, they're like, they're going to get their license to market, but they're still in like provisional zone for everything right now. So like,
and for the smaller brands, are they sort of counting on Philip Morris to do the court battle, and then they're just going to like ride like little barnacles?
They'll get first mover, and then like you just do the exact same thing. You put the exact same warnings on your label and your can as Zyn does. And for the Sesh guy, Max, who was a really good interview and a smart guy, he's like, the first movers have advantage here because we're trying to get to the regulatory rooms. So like we want to be in the room when people are talking about how to regulate these things in order to have influence over it. So it's like a little bit of regulatory capture for guys like Tucker Carlson. It's a little bit of a gold rush where he's like, I want to be in this marketplace because I know it's going to be big. And if I can make the fucking like reactionaries in, like might as well try and do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think Zyn means as like a class signifier? Like obviously you talk a lot about more as like a masculinity signifier.
Is it more expensive than cigarettes? Sorry, ignorant question.
I just bought the tin this weekend because we went to a Bills game and I can't remember how much it cost. It was cheaper than cigarettes.
Okay. it's 10 in a pack? 10 in a pack? I don't know.
14
I've never
in
said.
A pack.
Yeah, 14, okay.
Yeah. The class signifier thing is really interesting. When I went into this, I had a lot of, I have a lot of like outer social friend, like who's in, not a lot of people like my direct circle, but like a lot of folks I like one degree removed. And so I had this very specific association with who was doing it. And then I talked to a lot of people and there's no rhyme or reason to like why people's in and why they didn't. And like even the masculinity signifiers we put in the piece, like it's less about doing Zyn than it is about being associated with like this, the sort of second tier, like the second level meeting of Zyn that like actually have the, like the masculinity and political associations with it. So like the guy, I talked to a few veterans who are like firefighters or cops now, and like, just middle-class guys doing their thing. Talk to podcasters in Brooklyn, like doing Zyn. Like it's all over the place. It really is. But it is almost exclusively men, which is all like the one like sort of, you know, cohesive thing there.
You interviewed a guy named Jack Spittler, which I felt was really on the nose and like had to be included. I'd love to hear a little bit more about like, I don't know, just the random John Q. Publix.
Jack Spittler was introduced to me by another journalist named Charles McFarland. Shout out Charles, wonderful journalist. He wrote a piece. He wrote the piece about the hat factory in the Midwest that's doing like both the Trump Vans hats and the Harris Waltz hats. Great guy. He introduced me to Jack, who was a sergeant in the Marines, and that was just like a like perfect guy to talk to because he was like, he did snooze when he was in Norway and then switched to doing Zyn when he got back here. It was a ton of just like internet reporting, like going to Reddit and talking to people, which was always, it's always a funny exercise. It was a lot of like,
yeah, because if they turn on you, then you get
it's talking to people on Reddit, not my favorite thing in the world, but here we are. It's like how we're reporting these out. And then it was a lot of just going out and looking like...
Were you on like a Zen subreddit? Is it just called Zen?
Yeah. So there's like, you can look up like Zen and it'll just pop a bunch of subreddits, people talking about it.
Teddy, do you know about double Zen?
No.
We talked...
Is that when you just do two?
We talked about this on the Joe Weisenthal podcast.
Because he popped a Zen as soon as he started. Like, before we get started.
That's incredible.
Right. Well, I had a dream that there was something called double Zen, which was kind of like a double stuffed Oreo. And it was like the pouch was twice as big, but it was like really visible in your face. It would give you a lump. Because when you said it's more men, I really think that's like, there's something about putting something like, it's a little bit like unfeminine,
absolutely,
right? Because yeah, it's not really visible, but it does sort of change. Like, it does make your face look different, I think.
And there is this association I heard from a couple of marketing people. They're like, women associated with dip. And the uptake for women on chew tobacco is like basically nobody. And so there's that rough association between the two. But if you look in Scandinavia, it's really popular, like almost 50-50 gender-wise, which is also pretty interesting. And that's just because snus has been around a lot longer. I talked to a couple of Swedish friends who were like, actually, the tobacco-free smokeless pouches are much more feminine associated in Sweden than they are with snus because they don't have tobacco in them.
What do they have in them?
What's the benefit? Just nicotine salts, which anytime you put salts in something, it's like, it just gives you the image of like, oh wow, this is just like poison that you're putting.
Snoo sounds like something like a Moomin would say. Like more, like and a Moomin would Swedish... just be like, more snoo, please.
Isn't that what don't they snort snus?
That's snuff. Which snuff, is its own whole thing. Snus, if you hear a Swedish person say snus, it does sound like a cartoon character saying it too. So.
I think one thing we were talking about a second ago, like it's not necessarily just about doing it, but about being associated with it. I'm thinking of like all this like brain rot slang, like, I mean, Zinnernet, you know, Upper Deckies, but then I'm thinking about like Rizzler, Gat, like all these things where like I'll see, like I'll be scrolling my Instagram reels and there'll
skibbity
be some song. Yeah, it's like these like Skibbity Ohio songs. And it like, it feels very that where it's just
they're like sea shanties for people who never learned how to read.
That's good.
The internet vernacular of all this stuff, and talking to so many different people, there was one of my editors actually put in something from their like teenage son who had like used terms that I had never heard before. And I was like, damn, there it really is this like whole sub vernacular and stuff. But Lauren Schlossman, who hosts Throwing Fits, was one of the guys I interviewed, and he just like ran me through some of the like their like upper decky lip pillows, like all that. I was like, this
Zimbabwe.
I do appreciate the neologisms of like Zimbabwe. And someone asked for a 3 milligram and they're like, oh no, man, I'm not Cindy Crawford. I want a 6. And I'm like, this is wild.
That's wild. Happy.
Well, cause it's just like 3 letters. It's so easy to insert.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. I mean, what have been the most surprising responses or memorable responses to the piece? I didn't have a chance to read the comments. Maybe you're avoiding them, but
thankfully.
Comments off or nobody
comments
commented?
Off. No, comments off. Yeah.
Wow, what a privilege. Would have been nice if that was extended to me, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Did it make it back to the subreddit? Did it come full circle?
It hasn't really done that much. They did put some promo behind it. Like, I think there's a push alert on Sunday for it. And it came out, it was the front page of Sunday Styles on Sunday, which was like a huge milestone for me.
I
was really, really happy about that. So the response has been like a lot of folks glad that the Times finally did something on it, because I think like the Post had run something really big like 6 months ago. I know, I think Rebecca Jennings at Fox did something like almost a year ago now. It's like, it was very much like a Times is on it thing, but I think everyone was also happy.
When does like the Zen wave start? I can't remember. Is it like 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
It's like 2019-ish is when they started like so they released it in 2014 and then they did like a huge national distribution push in 2019. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And listen, they're making a ton of fucking money. PMI is like, we found our next thing. We found smoking again. Like, this is going to be great.
Well, I saw something because I know that there's like these Zen reward programs where it's like if you get all the – it's like box tops for cereal when you're a child or whatever. But
does the Rizzler come to your house?
No, but you can get –
The Rizzler will come to your office if you guys collect the most box tops.
The Rizzler's a 10-year-old child. The Rizzler does not Zen. You get
cameo credit for sending Zen into people.
But I saw something that was like my boyfriend got a barbecue from doing all his Zens. They just reinvented like – like they used to do this with cigarettes too, like decades ago.
It was cool. My entire mom, my uncles and aunts are all Japanese. They all smoke from the time they're 12, basically. And so the Marlboro shit they had was killer. It was
I have a Marlboro Henley.
Yeah, cool. Right. Yeah. The Zen Rewards thing, that has been one of the funny, that was actually one of the counterpoints on the gender association stuff. I was talking to Casey Lewis and she was there's a bunch of TikToks of girlfriends collecting their boyfriend's Zen cans and buying shit with them. And I thought this was a very funny little internet sub thing, but
women will do the actual coupon.
We'll take all the
classic, but they won't pack the Zen.
I have a couple times, but
I never have.
I got pretty, I mistimed it with my coffee a couple times and got pretty nauseous and was
I was up in Buffalo this weekend to go to a Bills game with some friends. And after the first 5 minutes, I'm this is awful. I'm oh, wait, now I understand why people like this.
Because probably can't smoke in the stadium either, but you can zin.
You can pop that zin in.
Did you have a garbage plate while you were in Buffalo?
No, a lot of wings.
Okay. Yeah.
That's
a classic.
It was good. Buffalo was fun. Yeah.
Sick. I guess would you consider this an election piece? Because the way you said you 6 months ago you started talking about it and then they wanted to do it now, obviously the timing seems pretty apt
for doing I'm a freelancer, so doing a piece doing a 2,000 word piece that's a cover piece in I think we did it in 2 weeks. I got the green light and my editor was we need this before the election, and I think I got the green light October 15th or something. And so, yeah, I think we wanted to run it as a piece about this new wave of online. Look, I all jokes aside, I do actually think that the this chronically online masculinity crisis, masculinity crisis, which of course sounds like a ridiculous term to say something about, but I do actually think that's a really important thing for people to look at with more critical eyes, because I think there's a lot of guys. And again, it's giving sympathy to 23-year-old dudes who have all the sympathy in the world, but also, they're as Jeffrey Sonnenfeld said, they are kind of they're not getting anything. They're getting fucked. In the way that both society is doing to them and they're doing to themselves. But they are there's a total failure launch for so many of these guys, and they're so susceptible to really gnarly shit out there. And I know younger cousins and nephews and shit. And it is your brain is just absorbing all this pretty, nasty stuff from a lot of these
guys. As you were talking about First Mover, I was thinking about I didn't read Max's internet piece, but I was wondering if he talks about gambling and sports gambling being extended to so many aspects of culture, because I think Polymarket is sort of the first mover in that situation. And I expect if you have a really big audience, I don't know, maybe Mr. Beast is a bad example, you could see submarkets being launched by influencers in the same way. And
absolutely,
but Polymarket's going to take the brunt of the regulatory whatever. They're the goose flying at the front of the V, right?
Yeah. And they get the sort of the benefit of regulatory capture, where they get to influence exactly what the policies are, which can keep other people out. But I think that's a very good point, in that sports gambling is a perfect analog for this stuff, because it's something you can do by yourself, and it's
frictionless automated vice.
Exactly. It is Zen and sports gambling, Zen and FanDuel and DraftKings and shit is this perfect 1-2 punch of I don't need to interact with anybody. This is just purely utilitarian. I can press this button and put $20 down on Derrick Henry scoring a touchdown. I can pop the 6 milligrams in. I don't have to go anywhere and talk to anybody.
Frictionless is my least favorite type of vice, but I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I like smoking. I don't like vaping, really.
And listen, no one likes
vaping. There's no ritual, right?
No.
There's no ritual.
Yeah.
Last, I have one more question for me. Were there any threads or points that didn't make it into the final piece that you wish had?
I'm Max Reed is one of my favorite writers and thinkers, and I leaned on him a little bit more in the first draft, and because I think his analysis for that piece was so spot on. Max does something that I don't do very well, which is think in terms of systems of technology and how larger threads are going through the world. And so I really appreciate that about him, and I wanted to include a little bit more of this internet piece in it, because I think this is really it echoes a lot of what he was talking about, and I wanted to pay a little more homage to him, but we also wanted to make sure that we were getting a lot of different voices in. So someone like Sam Adler Bell was great to also include in this, because I think it was important to think about this as how are we thinking about political symbols in 2024 and how shit shows up in Instagram and how it shows up in TikTok and like, what's that, what is that doing to how people think? So, I think we did it. Getting 2000 words in the Times is sort of a fewer and far between exercise now. Everything is trending towards, you know, smaller and smaller. So I was really happy we got like to the oxygen to actually give this piece, you know, what it needed to be.
Well, don't do what I did, which is I took my little $2 a word and I bought myself a nice watch and then I lost it.
I was thinking about doing that.
Well, just don't do the losing part.
Just doing the losing part. I'm going to do everything else.
Teddy, if you want to go to Grand Seiko, I will come with you as your watch whisperer. We can do a little Grand Seiko field trip.
That sounds nice. I was thinking about getting a suit too. We'll see. But I don't wear suits anymore.
Gotta go to Drake's. Truly. Get the La Chimera linen. I'm telling you.
Listen. This is fun, guys. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for coming on short notice.
Of course. Yeah, anytime.
Well, I thought that was really fun. I'm still not inspired to go do Zins, but I'm also like, I don't know. I one thing that I thought was interesting about the piece is like all the photos are of like just dudes around New York City, like downtown bars, doing Zin, which is an interesting choice, I think, from the photo editors, because I don't know. I would have liked to see more like the nation's Zinternet, like, you know, somebody
farmers
doing a Zin in Iowa. Yeah.
Somebody canvassing with a Zin in.
Canvas in. Jesus Christ. No, I don't know. I feel like I'm really curious if Zins are going to be such this short-lived thing. Like something that Teddy was talking about is how it's just like this, it's this gold rush and like this gold rush of like putting a culture war flag on it because it's so new. Whereas like, I mean, tobacco vapes, I can't remember, like 10 years ago, I feel like when Juul came out or whatever, and it was such a thing. Like you have to imagine with Zin, it's going to be like in 5 to 10 years, it's just a normal like tobacco product at the bodega that like isn't polarized in any way.
Yeah. I mean, I think these trends can create new tobacco consumers if they catch people who are like aging into getting access to it because they're in high school.
Well, proven with vapes, right?
Yeah. God forbid middle school. Yeah. My husband Juuls more than he ever smoked cigarettes. Yeah. And so it creates new users. But I think there's like a portion of people who are just going to be new users. There's a portion of people who are just going to like try it. It's a trend. Obviously, it's stickier than other trends because there's an addictive substance in it. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder if like the number of like true
less
nicotine
sticky
addicts
than a cigarette, though,
is sort of like energy. Like it's kind of stable, but it's transferred from format to format.
Yeah.
And that's probably just going to still trend down anyway. If you look at cigarette use and Juul use and the statistics in the article. And I think the little like bumps up over time are those like social trend.
But it continues to go down
followers.
Over time.
Yeah. Yeah. The trend will continue to go down because the trend is really capturing like the number of people who are habitual nicotine users.
Yeah. Well, Emily is here, so
all right,
let's talk to her. Round two.
Hello.
Okay, let's get into it. So, you had a piece published, I think, last Wednesday, in the Guardian, titled "Vaginas in Times Square: Birth Control Has Been Rebranded."
Yeah, was that your title, Emily?
No, I do not come up with the headlines.
Alas,
okay, public service announcement.
But wait, I want to finish the thing. So, birth control has been rebranded, but are women's the ones benefiting?
Yes.
So what's the answer? Did you answer that question?
No.
Sorry, no.
I don't. That's the thing about most of my articles is I'm like, here's a question and here's some convincing arguments on either side and you figure it out because I sure don't know.
Well, I think my takeaway was like, so that question is obviously you didn't like pose that question exactly, but it's about like direct to consumer women's health brands flourishing post Roe v. Wade. I don't know, talking to these people that you spoke to, some like the heads, people who work for these new companies, if Roe hadn't fallen, do you think this market would look like it does now?
I think that it would. We would still have a proliferation of these brands. I think like even starting back in like 2017, 2018, around Me Too, that's when people started thinking like, oh, women are interesting, right? Women are a story. Women's healthcare is something that we should be looking at because there was all this attention on it. And then also we had the pandemic, which shifted a lot of focus to telehealth. And so I think like even before, and there were a lot of attacks on birth control, abortion, even before Roe fell. So I think we were heading in this direction. You just saw this like stratospheric takeoff of demand and also investor interest in this like discrete moment after Roe fell.
Totally. I mean, people saw the success of companies like Glossier and they applied the same playbook to women's health. And we kind of got into this a little bit on our episode with Joe Weisenthal, where we talked about like the startup boom that happened in like the aughts, basically.
Yeah, your Gin Lane branded
startups, and like how much interest rates, like low interest rates factor into this, where like investors are just throwing money at things. And I think what my takeaway from this article was a lot of what's happening, like obviously if your total addressable market is like 50% of the population, or you could argue it's 50% of the population, although you're kind of coming to an age, a relevant age segment within that, like theoretically, that's a strong enough argument to, for the market, whether Roe is in place or not, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I took away is this is very downstream of the science or innovation. And it's taking something that already exists, the science that already exists, like Plan B, and just coming up with a fancy package for it, or maybe a little bit of an ease of distribution that didn't exist before. But to me, like what really helps women is like very, very upstream, which is like money going into actual science, money going into like new solutions for women's health. You know, I hear a lot about like the untapped market of like menopause health and like, oh, how can we create more research around that so we can ultimately create more products around it and like market them to people. And so I think, to me, if more people have access, and more people have access because people are doing Glossier packaging for Plan B, sure, fine. But I also think it obscures a little bit like what we really don't know about women's health and the gaps in the market, because there's no market incentive for people to do research that the incentive really comes into play when you can just like get it in store, get it in Target, you know?
Yeah. I think like that's a subject I feel so passionately about, is the lack of research into women's health specifically. And like the fact that every woman you know has chronic fatigue or like chronic pain or IBS, and then you go to the doctor and they have no answers on any of those things. And I mean, even the fact that we don't have a male birth control yet, right? It's like, okay, we can, should we be focusing on like rebranding Plan B, or should we like get a birth control that works for men? I mean, I think the answer is both. These are like products that we know work well, and so increasing access to them is not a bad thing. I just wish that there were the kind of incentives that exist for these products for the like hard work of finding solutions for other trickier women's health problems.
There was, you talked to this one VC firm that like their whole purpose was like to fund kind of these women's health ventures, right? Or were they working on like working with other businesses like
Wait,
this?
Wait, is that the Starface? That's more of a holding company.
This was, I think, Rhea Ventures is a fund that focuses, and we only really talked about their like work on birth control and Plan B and that stuff. But I mean, there definitely are more and more funds that are focusing specifically on women's health. Like honestly, even Nicole Shanahan had one before she decided to run for vice president. But like, I think that that is becoming, I mean, for better or worse, it's becoming trendy. It's seeing sort of like the same resurgence that we're seeing with contraceptives. But just to a lesser degree, I think, because it's not as easy to sell.
Yeah. I just think for me, some of these products are serving as like a stopgap. And like, this is a very American thing, that ubiquity of access to stuff like SSRIs through like Hims or whatever, give the illusion that we're like a well society, but we're not a well society. We can get certain things cheap that sort of function as band-aids for what's actually wrong.
Well, yeah, wait, something I wrote down from the piece, I'll quote it, which I didn't know, and it's like crazy to me. The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, rules that regulate how pharmaceutical manufacturers advertise their products do not apply to the doctors and telehealth companies that sell them. So I had no idea that like Hims or, you know, any of these, Jolie or whatever, are not regulated in the same way as like the actual manufacturer. That seems really troubling. to me.
Yeah. I had no idea about that either. And like, to be clear, they don't regulate doctors either. So like mm-hmm. any doctor, you know, in the past could have like set up shop and been like, I'm selling a miracle cure that is Tylenol, you know, and that, and I don't know, maybe their like board would have come for them for that, but they're not regulated by the FDA. They can advertise however they want. But I think it's just so much more prevalent when you have these like large, you know, venture-backed companies that are really investing in advertising and making it the same kind of advertising you're seeing, you know, for lip gloss. And it doesn't have to have all of the disclosures and all of the, and then the other part of it is that you're not going in to a doctor before you're getting it to get some of that more basic preventative healthcare, which I think is what a lot of folks are worried about.
Yeah.
And like, yeah.
I mean,
Daisy, to your point,
go ahead.
No, to say to your point, like, I think that's the Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. That's what this Band-Aid is covering up. The fact that we don't have, like, 30 to 50% of communities don't have an OBGYN in the U.S. Like, people don't have access to standard healthcare. And so we have to come up with these, like, solutions that, great, they help some people, but, you know, they wouldn't have helped someone like me who has like a blood clotting disorder and can't take the pill. I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't gone into a doctor. And so, yeah, I think that's the gaping issue we're covering up that we have to solve.
Yeah. And I think like some market incentives for women's health make sense because market incentives, in my opinion, do breed innovation. Or, you know, you can see it in like what you would call green capitalism, which is like, okay, yeah, we want people to have some incentive to create solar panels or something that can take carbon out of the atmosphere. But, you know, with women's health, it's like you look at something like Flow, which has been valued at over $1 billion, and it's a period tracking app. And it's like, where's that valuation coming from? It has to be the data, because it's not, that's where the actual value is in the app. And like, that's, I think women find that really frightening, especially post-Row. And then, you know, I signed up for something that like, you know, women's health startup that seemed like it would give you access to getting a mammogram sort of like a la carte rather than having to go through like a whole rigmarole with insurance and like OBGYN, which by the way, even if you do have access in your community, you could be waiting like 3 months if you're a new patient to see an OBGYN, like 2-3, like it's crazy. So I was like, let me sign up for this. And they take you all the way through. They collect all of your data. They take your email address. And at the end, they say, it's not available in your state. And it's like, oh, I just got played. Like, this is a data collection company. They have no product. They have nothing on offer. They are not actually approved to say, to do what they say they're going to do. And I think women can be easy targets for that because we know that our health is like not really considered and we have anxiety around it.
Yeah. And I don't know if any of these companies that I wrote about are partaking in the practice of sharing people's data. And so like, I don't want to comment on them or cast any aspersions on them, but I know that in the research I've done, this is a problem among telehealth companies that many of them have been very, if not purposefully selling people's data, have been very lax with data security. And that is really troubling for researchers in this space. And that's something that like folks should look into before they order from any of these companies. That's a big risk.
One thing I was thinking about reading this is like, obviously just gendered sex-related advertising in the New York City subway system. So like the Hims ads like a decade ago, with like the erectile dysfunction cactuses. And then there was the thing where Thinks was trying to do their ads with grapefruit and eggs. And the text was for women with periods. But then out front, the company who does those ads said, no, like it's too, you can't do that. But then, you know, Thinks pushed back and then it was approved and it was fine. And now it's like, okay, now there's an ad that says vagina in Times Square. And that like, I mean, speaking about like the whole innovation side of it, it seems like, I don't know if in the past 10 years, like there has been like, you know, huge steps forward in like the actual like upstream, like science, et cetera. But it seems like this kind of empty thing of like, okay, well now like it's easier for advertisers, for marketers to like advertise these products, but like it's, that's just better for them to make money, not like better for the end user, for not better for women, right?
Yeah. This is a question I had through the entire piece. I'm like, okay, we're having these very bold advertisements. You're like saying the word vagina, like Wisp has like kind of pop art vulvas in some of their posters and stuff. And it's like, is that is that progress for feminism?
Yeah.
Like, you know, on the surface, yes. Is it, or is it progress for, is it a good marketing tactic?
Mm-hmm. I kind of veer towards that.
Yeah, it could be both, you know. I don't know, like, at this point, if being more, if being less discreet about what you're advertising as a product is doing a lot for women rather than actually just improving that product and thinking of better products.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if it helps people feel less freaked out about getting care, that's always great. I would just be so curious to see internally, like in, you know, focus groups and stuff, like how mm-hmm. people are reacting to this and if it is making a difference to women to see this or not.
Yeah. So the timing of this piece feels very, you know, it's like an election piece, obviously. How long had you been working on it, or had you pitched it some months ago? How did it come about?
I honestly, no, this came about really quickly. I was sort of thinking about this stuff. I was seeing all of these ads popping up, and had like used some of these companies a few times for other stuff. And so I was familiar with them and interested in them. And then actually my editor of The Guardian reached out to me. And was like, hey, would you want to write about sort of this in the context of specifically Plan B and contraceptives? And I was like, absolutely. But this piece came together in like 2 weeks, and it took a lot of my brain power for those 2 weeks. But yeah, it's something that I have, this market is something that I think about a lot. I also think mm-hmm. about it like in terms of telehealth for abortions,
yeah.
and the abortion pill, and sort of like all the different reasons that that is helpful and also complicated. And so it's a subject that I've been thinking about for a while, but really just started writing about recently.
Yeah. I think, I mean, to talk about the question about like whether this is feminism or progress, like, I think we see the example of like how two female presidential candidates were differently marketed, right? To the extent that like a campaign is a marketing
Yeah.
campaign as well. And, you know, a lot of people have talking about like, you know, this time around, we're not talking about the first woman president, right? We're talking about like other issues. And mm-hmm. for me, I can't help but feel like women's healthcare, like direct to consumer, will have succeeded when it's not really framed as women's healthcare, but like a net good for everyone, where even like abortion has been like a really critical issue this election, although like under, I think under measured until the end. It sort of was like riding along as an economic issue, or, you know, an issue for everyone. And maybe that messaging shows more progress and more success, even though on its face has sort of like removed the woman and female branded components. And, you know, there's no pink pussy hats this time around.
Right. That's like honestly exactly the conclusion that I sort of came to after writing this is like, look, are people selling really beautifully packaged birth control Plan B and marketing it very suavely, delivering it to your doorstep, the enemy? No, they're giving people a service that they really need in a time when it's hard to access. They're making money doing it, but they are providing a very crucial service that's under attack. But it just bums me out that we have to like lump the marketing and branding for these products and conversation around these products into this sort of like girl boss feminism mm-hmm. conversation, because it's not about that, right? It's mm-hmm. not about like female empowerment and being a boss bitch. It's like, it's healthcare.
It's healthcare. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like the real point of the conversation is, again, that it's like more than a third of counties in the US don't have an OBGYN. And like, that's,
yes.
that's the only thing that really matters here, is that like, this is some form of access, but it shouldn't be like, it's not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not like enough. And
pinkwashing. Yeah, yeah, everything.
Right. And to be fair, every person that I talked to, like from the side of these companies, agreed with that. And mm-hmm. were like, yes, we need to be funding the clinics. We need to be helping fund in-person care. I, like, multiple people use the phrase both and with me.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of these clinics are moving into also providing virtual care. They're not marketing in the same way. They mm-hmm. don't have the same marketing budgets. But they understand that there are patients that they can't reach in person. And so they understand how helpful telehealth can be. So they're not against using it. I think it's just like a difference in how it's marketed.
Ones that like in-person care is like very expensive and like isn't profitable and shouldn't be like wildly profitable in the way that like a marketed direct-to-consumer pill can be.
Right.
Because like what the compromises that you have to make if you're chasing venture scale returns, like really should never have a relationship with like something somebody is putting in their body.
I just read, do you guys know the mushroom company Small Hold?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. So they were like, it was like one of these like VC funded organic farming startups that I was really interested in. And then I just learned yesterday that in August or like at the beginning of the year, they announced a bankruptcy. And then I read like an essay that was from August from one of the co-founders talking about how like you can't eat technology. And like they had tried to scale as like this, like not a food company, we're a tech company, but they were actually all along just a farming company and the model kind of collapsed. And so this is just making me think of that too, where it's like, yeah, you there's not going to be like private sector money isn't going to flow into like putting an OBGYN in that third of counties that don't have them, right? Because it's like, that's just not the model. I don't know. It's sad. And like, obviously that should be like publicly funded, but.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that Erica Seth Davies at RIA was saying, as she was like, there's probably different funding streams for each of these things. Yeah. A lot of the stuff that's supporting clinics is philanthropy and is like government funding. And we need to fight for more of that. But, you know, like Peter Thiel is pouring a ton of money into women's health companies. I mean, kind of weird ones that promote not taking the pill and only cycle tracking and very sort of like oddly
data
backwards
companies.
Yeah. But, you know, he's not going to put money into putting an OBGYN in your, you know, rural county and people who think like him aren't going to. So it's about sort of lifting up other sources of income for those providers.
Yeah. I mean, obviously a lot of innovation comes out of America and Silicon Valley, but I don't think it's a coincidence that Novo Nordisk is a Scandinavian company because of the upstream scientific research that had to go into actually developing like the basis for Ozempic and, you know, everything that will follow.
Two questions working on this article. I'm curious if there's anything that you learned while working on it that like surprised you or like was, you had no idea. And then if there's any threads you kind of want to like pick back up for a future article.
Yeah. I think a big one was what we already talked about, which is that the FDA doesn't regulate advertising for these companies. I think that that was really huge. And I think that I talked to another researcher who sort of gave me a perspective that I hadn't had before, a new way of looking at this, which is that these companies are kind of turning the model we have for healthcare on its head. And that instead of going into a doctor and talking about how you're feeling, you know, your background, getting your stats done, you just go to a website and you click shop treatments. And that is totally the reverse. And then you go and tell them about your symptoms and but that is completely reversing the model that we've
foregone
had.
Conclusions.
Yeah. And turning this into a consumer good that you just shop. And so now I'm struck by that every time I go onto a telehealth website that it's like shop here, you know, buy this product. And I'm like, oh, that is not how people of our parents' generation and before that interacted with healthcare. And again, there are good things and bad things about that. You know, there are upsides and downsides. I think probably if you're a woman, like I said in the piece, and you know you have a yeast infection, like you don't need to go to the doctor and have a long visit and, you know, build for that. You can just go shop treatment. But there are other circumstances where maybe that's not fitting. And it's a very interesting change to watch.
Yeah, I feel like it's the illusion of concierge healthcare for the middle class, though. But it's like the difference between DoorDash and a Michelin starred restaurant, right? Because like if you have true concierge healthcare, which a lot of wealthy people pay for on top of insurance, you know, and like that's the incentive of having a private plan. Basically, if you're somewhere with universal healthcare, then like you could just call your doctor the day that you want to talk to them. You wouldn't have to wait 4 months. And so I think the wait time, the not knowing how much something's going to cost before you go in, pushes a lot of people to be like, okay, I Googled my symptoms. I'm 80% sure it's a yeast infection. So let me spend the $14 that
Yeah.
I know it's going to be.
And I think in terms of threads to pick up on, I would love to be able to look at more long-term the effects of this, as well as the effects of this specifically on long-acting contraception, things like the Mirena IUD, things like the implant, because you can't get those through these services. And I know that, you know, when I was younger and thinking about birth control, those were very attractive options. Those were options that everyone was talking about. And I wonder if that's switched for this generation, or if there has been a switch at all, because it's not something you can buy online.
I honestly think we're 10 years out from them sending a robot to your house to punch a hole in your arm. Like, as much as I like really hate to say it.
Yeah.
Maybe this could be your book, Emily.
Maybe it could. The future of reproductive medicine. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot to write about there.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot. But it's definitely an interesting one. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on to talk about it.
Yeah. Thanks, thank you guys so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks. It tastes just like it costs. Well, this was a fun one.
Yeah, I think the thread connecting these two pieces is the FDA, actually.
Yes, yes. I wasn't sure.
I mean, FDA, the original tastemaker. The original taste. They tell us what we're allowed to taste.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. Because like, going into it, too, I was like, well, it's kind of, you know, obviously these are both like kind of pointed election pieces, like I brought up to both of them. And it's like, okay, so the one, they're, you know, very gendered dichotomy here. And one is about like dudes with dudes like consuming tobacco, and the other one's like a much more high stakes like women's healthcare and like making up the gap of like our healthcare system being terrible. And I was trying to think, like, did I read any other pieces out there, like kind of, you know, that were written around the election that were more about like some crisis of health? There's no crisis of health for men. I don't know. It's just a reflection of this country.
I mean, I think there's a crisis of mental health for mental men, health, but I don't know that it's going to help with it.
Yeah. Do you think Zins help with men's mental health?
I think the Zinternet is a replacement for some sort of belonging. And we could do a whole other episode on that.
Well, I think what Teddy was talking about too, about like the you know, Zins and sports betting, it's like these are both things that are certainly terrible for men's mental health.
Right. Because like frictionless vice is buying something online. Vice with friction is probably going to your local bar and you have the opportunity for community
and
there.
You meet people.
I do think the third spaces thing is overblown. And like maybe we should have
a third spaces expert on
Magdalena Taylor on the podcast because she does a lot of it's the phone stupid type stuff. But yeah, well, I think there's a lot of threads to pull on here.
Yeah. They're both about frictionless products, right? Like obvious, I mean, what we talked to Emily about is about like frictionless healthcare products because the actual healthcare system is so frictioned, where it's like this is like an option that like you people have to pick because maybe they don't have an option, whereas then Zins is like, oh, this is like a more modern convenience friction that's like not because of something sinister or not because of some like huge gap in how our government approaches healthcare.
Well, I also think it's an indication that like the so-called culture war isn't just memetic, but there's these like microeconomies around the culture war and like the gender war aspects of it that are like sort of like functioning the same way that like millennial like ZERP era decision making was. But now rather than decision making being like, post-recession, like where is their surplus? Oh, people's cars, they could be taxis. Now it's all just like, where's the culture war arbitrage play?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking more too of like, just the word frictionless is just stuck in my head, ironically, I suppose. But like
friction land, welcome to friction land. Well,
friction. I mean, it's the same thing with like no code software, whereas like millennials grew up, you know, making MySpace pages, learning HTML, and now Gen Z kids are just putting tobacco-less nicotine salt pouches.
Well, you know,
in their mouth.
Francis, that's why I like urinating, because it's emotional friction.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I answered, not that I was, this predates my inclusion in any dirt, you know, reader contributor surveys, but I think yearning is the default state of life. Yearning is literally is life.
Mm. We should do Salt Life on the side. This came up
Salt
because
Life. Salt Life is bankrupt, right?
Are they? Well,
they went bankrupt recently.
I saw somebody saying the chat pile should make a sticker in the Salt Life font, and we could do a Yearning is Life Salt Life font.
That would be good. Yearning Life. Yeah. Cool. Well, I think we'll end it here. By the time everyone is listening to this, the election will have happened. But this was kind of our little election special, I suppose.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a time machine to the future us who will wake up tomorrow and listen to this and hopefully have more information.
Yeah, we'll know. Maybe.
What's gonna happen to this great country?
It's truly a great country. Okay, this has been Tasteland. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. See you next week.